Hi there. You're listening to Sample Space. This is a podcast where we try to highlight some good ideas in the realm of data science, and preferably also some ideas that might otherwise go overlooked. My name is Vincent, and I will be your host. In this episode, we're talking to Peter Bull, and he's well known for a few things. The main reason why we're talking to him today is because he started a Python project known as the Dion Checklist, which is just a very pragmatic checklist of cautionary tales that you want to keep in the back of your mind when you're doing a data project. But Peter is also well known for being the co-founder of a company called Driven Data. This is a consultancy company, but they also have a pretty sizable competition platform that is like Kaggle, but just a little bit different. There's more emphasis on doing social good with these competitions, and the datasets also tend to be a little bit more interesting sometimes. The main theme that we will be discussing in this episode is just, if you want to do ethical things with data, how can you actually do that in a pragmatic way? There's a bunch of interesting anecdotes in this one, and I really hope you enjoy the conversation. Hey, Peter.
Hey, Vincent. How's it going?
Good. Been a busy day. It's like end of the day for me, beginning of the day for you, thanks to the magic of time differences.
It has not been a busy day for me yet, luckily.
Yeah. Well, so that's kind of cool, because we can kind of get the day rolling in a way then. Because Peter, the reason why we're talking is because I think you've been a sort of driving force behind this Dion checklist, which is this data science checklist that I've been impressed by for a few years. And I kind of want to sort of get to the origin story of that. I think that's a nice way to start. But in order to talk about that, I think we also have to talk about this company that I believe you're the co-founder of as well, like Driven Data. So let's see if we can sort of start there and then sort of move our way towards this tool that I'm a big fan of. I think that could be like a fun little conversation. So, Peter, you co-founded a company. Like, how did that go?
Well, that wasn't the original idea, but here we are nonetheless, 10 years later. So I'll give you sort of maybe a couple of useful signposts along the way on my journey. The first is that I did my undergrad degree in philosophy, focusing on practical ethics, and I did not do a computer science degree or an engineering degree or a data degree or anything like that. It didn't really exist at the time, but I sort of got lucky. This was a bit before the 2008 financial crash, and so I got into this kind of program that stopped existing after 2008, where it was basically an apprenticeship program for a software engineering job at Microsoft. Half the day was programming training. Half the day I worked on a product team. If they liked you after 9 months and you learned enough, you got to stay there full time. And so that's sort of where my technical training, my programming sort of came from originally. And so then I worked there for 5 years. And while I was there, I kept getting asked data questions and got more interested in sort of figuring out the statistics around, I was on the user experience team. They get a lot of telemetry data around making conclusions about what are good or bad changes to the UI.
And out of curiosity, because you do mention it was early, like what might have been the tools that were sort of used back then? I can imagine it was a little bit too early for the big Python wave, right?
Yeah. I mean, this was all in SQL, big SQL databases. Yeah. And I mean, all the code at Microsoft was C++ and C#, as you might imagine. So yeah, before Python, I picked Python up as a hobby language in 2010 or so, just for playing with some things locally, doing some web apps for fun. Everything at work was in C++ and C#. And I kept getting asked these data questions that like, I didn't feel like I really knew enough statistics to handle. So I went back to grad school and I did what today would be called a data science degree, but at that time was a computational science degree. It was sort of like the folks that were starting this program weren't sure whether like very fine-grained simulation on supercomputers or machine learning was going to win out as our like modes of creating tools to better understand scientific questions. And I think to some degree, machine learning has won that. So while I was there, I wanted to sort of bring together my background in practical ethics. I wanted to work on things that I cared about. So I was like, well, these machine learning tools seem really useful for lots of kinds of problems. how can they be used in the social sector? What social impact problems can we use machine learning on? And at the time, this was 2013, fall of 2013, spring of 2014, there weren't a lot of examples of machine learning and social impact. Like, if you think about that early era of machine learning, what do you think about as the applications?
I mean, what I remember from that era is, I mean, I was really just getting started back then, like definitely beginning of my career. And I do recall scikit-learn definitely being like a thing. Like that we definitely had that. But yeah, you would think like banking, like the beginner recommender system, like that would be kind of the stuff, right?
Yeah,
that's like what that, I vaguely remember, at least.
Like people spend a lot of time talking about ad click optimization. Like how do we go from 0.2% click rate to 0.3% click rate? And those were the things, like, you know, within the margins of these products, you can shift behavior to some degree with machine
learning. Yeah, it was also a fair bit of stuff, like, because mobile was still relatively new. So you also had like lots of sensor user data coming out of these mobile phones that people wanted to do stuff with. But definitely in the ad click optimization-y, optimizely-ish domain. Like that, I think it's fair to say that a lot of the use cases came from that domain.
Sure. Yeah, and almost all of the use cases came out of large tech companies that, like you were saying, had what we called big data at the time, that a lot of listeners are probably familiar with the term.
Hadoop.
But Hadoop, yeah. We thought that was going to be the hype wave term that we rode on was big data, but it morphed into data science pretty quickly. So I wanted to apply these tools, these machine learning tools, to social impact questions. I talked to a like-minded colleague about this idea, and I talked to...
At Microsoft, this was
No, this is a grad school.
Right, okay. So when you say colleague, was like a fellow student, or was that like...
Student at grad school. And then a friend of mine who happened to be in business school at the time, and the friend of mine in business school was like, we should start something. And I was like, well, I'm really interested in these kinds of applications of this machine learning toolkit. It seems like a lot of opportunity. And when we talked to organizations, we started at that point, like reaching out and talking to social impact organizations. Most of them didn't really know what to do with data. They had started collecting data. They had local databases, but they didn't really know what they might use that data for besides reporting.
And what kind of orgs? I'm thinking you're like NGO kind of things, right? But these are more local, or what kind? Could you name one?
Yeah, it's pretty broad. So I'll tell you a little bit about the first organization that we ran a challenge with was an education budgeting organization. And so these can be like hyper-specialized organizations. This was a national-level organization. They worked with schools all over the country. But school districts in the U.S. don't have reporting standards for their budgets. What that means is if you look at a budget line item, hey, we spent, $20,000 on textbooks. There's not a standard category that textbooks fits into that's mandated for all schools. And what that means is that school districts can't say, hey, are we spending more on textbooks? Are we spending more on facilities? Are we spending more on extracurricular activities? How do we think about, is our budget responsible in relation to our peers?
And you can't compare one budget of one school with a budget of another school unless you got some of these line items like bucketed the right way. Yeah, I can see that.
Exactly. And I think I could already see your wheels turning. That sounds like we've got a classification problem of some sort on our hands here.
Yeah. So something light NLP, something. Yeah. A little bit in that domain.
And so what the nonprofit did was they went through these budgets line by line and said, oh, let me read this. This is a facilities charge here. This is for teacher salaries. This is for our sports programs, and created these categories, attached them to budgets, then created these roll-ups to compare schools against each other, and then made recommendations about how to better allocate the budget. And so, like, the important part, the impact, was about allocating the budget, thinking about those comparisons. But they spent a ton of time on this data cleaning task. I like to call it an unnatural language processing task, rather than NLP, because, like, budgets use all kinds of shorthand. It was like, you know, every word gets truncated at four characters, all the vowels get dropped out, capitalization is totally arbitrary.
There's probably a typo or two in there.
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of interesting to me. I've been meaning to go back and look at how LLMs do on it, because I have a hunch that so many of the tokens won't actually be found because they are like the vowels have been dropped out of words. And so I'm curious if solving this problem needs a new scheme or not.
They can still resort to individual characters, I think, but either way, it is interesting to double check. I can definitely imagine. Or, I mean, like, even if not for LLMs, even for the bigger BERT models, you could definitely argue they're not trained on spelling errors. So there you already kind of go. Or a lot of these, like, there's also like super special abbreviations here usually that only make sense if you're like a faculty member, like those sorts of things, right? Like at some point it's almost like an anthropological exercise to understand the line item.
So it is. There's like a domain specific language in there, right?
So, but to bring it back to the story then, because I can imagine, like, okay, you were sort of looking around for like, hey, can we do sort of social good NGO-y more kind of work? Because you don't want to spend your time doing ad click optimization. And then you start, like, how did you actually get into contact with these people? Was it just sort of you looking around meetups and sort of, is that how the ball got rolling? Or
like, yeah, it was like reaching out to local organizations and saying, hey, you know, we're grad students, we work on data questions, like, does your organization have data need? Data need, like, how do you think about data? We'd love to talk to you. And luckily, some folks just said yes to that kind of email.
So it was basically like, oh, this sounds like an interesting organization in terms from the social avenue. Let's cold call them and see what happens. That's kind of how it went.
Yeah. And we started with places that were headquartered locally or at offices locally. So at least we could meet up with them and, you know, sort of had that in common.
Because where was your grad school?
I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Right. Not a small town. Like, you'll find some folks there. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
I can imagine if this were like a small college town, that might have been a bit harder. But yeah, Cambridge will not be the smallest college
city.
Towns.
You've got lots of options there. But while we were calling these organizations, we realized that we spent a lot of time basically discussing what use cases might look like in their area. And on our side, trying to do this sort of pattern matching, like what sort of fits a machine learning task. And that's really where the idea for the piece that Driven Data started with came from, which is how do we set up case studies that organizations can look at and say, oh, I also work on building water pumps or wells in the developing world. And I see a case study where an organization that does the same kind of thing does predictive maintenance, for example. It says, okay, they've reduced the amount of time that an area goes without water because they service the wells in a smarter way based on the data that's available. I might be able to do the same kind of thing with my data for my programs that I have. So we started to think about how do we create this library of case studies that people are interested in from the social sector side? And at the same time, how do we create that library for people who are learning the data science and machine learning toolkit, for people that have those skills already to say, I don't have to go work at a tech company for someone to give me interesting data that's a good fit for machine learning. Those kinds of opportunities are also in the social sector.
So you say something interesting there. Was it also feedback you got from your fellow students that they were kind of worried that they were going to be optimizing clicks all day and that they were actually more interested in having a bit? Was that part of the story as well? It seems like you had a small realization there.
Yeah, it was part of the story to some degree. Like a lot of folks in machine learning, a lot of my fellow students really were passionate about the methods, right?
Yeah.
They cared about the math. They cared about like how elegant a solution was. It's almost like we were really focused on just what's the most interesting way to solve a problem. The problem itself, like, you know, doesn't matter as much. But I've always been sort of practical, applied thinker, and that's where I wanted to spend my time.
Yeah, okay. But I can also see the appeal where You don't have to think about the use case too much, but really go down a technical rabbit hole and get the best accuracy. That does attract a couple of people. That is a fun exercise that I do, that I can see. Yeah,
totally fun. It's actually one of the things that's fun about the challenges too, is that you get to focus on just that piece if you're a machine learning person.
So maybe this would be a good time to just explain the challenges, because we're kind of getting there, I think. Because you were talking to all these NGOs, you saw a couple of interesting use cases. But I guess like you were wondering, like, how can we scale this in a way and also get exposure for it? And I think that's where kind of driven data and also the challenges that you do kind of came from, right? So maybe that will be how did that happen? Like when was it clear that was going to be the path forward?
Maybe give the first overview of how the challenges work, start from there. So we run what is now, though wasn't at the time, basically a standard machine learning challenge where we give participants a training set. And we give them the features for that training set and the labels for that training set. Then we give them the features for a test set. We say, hey, predict the labels on the test set. They send those predictions to us. We compare them against the labels for the test set that we have, but we haven't given to them, so we can get an accuracy score. We then use that to rank the submissions that people make. Person with the highest submission wins a prize. And then we can use that code. So all of the winning solutions to driven data challenges are open source. In exchange for open sourcing it, you get a prize. And then we can help the organization to use that method or learn from that method going forward. So that's the basic structure of how the challenges work. And the idea was that challenges are this nice focusing mechanism where we've gotten to the point that we're going to get something much more tangible out of it than a hackathon, which was sort of the other thing that we talked about. Maybe a hackathon's a good thing. We're like organizing hackathons around data. But we really wanted these case studies that were specific and showed results. And that's what a challenge was good for, where we could get sort of enough attention on a very focused problem where we've already done the upfront work to say, hey, there's a machine learning piece here. So like that education budgeting example I gave earlier, we did all the work to prep that data and set it up to make it available for the challenge and say, hey, here's what you need to do with this. Here's all the budget information. Here's the categories for these budget line items. Now it's your job to figure out how to best process this data and set up your algorithms to categorize new budget line items that come in.
And because you, I mean, nowadays, Kaggle is kind of most well known for doing this sort of thing, right? Did you guys start around the same time?
Yeah, I think Kaggle was a little earlier than we were. We started in, our first challenge was in 2014.
Right. They might have been like a year or so earlier, but not like a decade.
Yeah.
Okay,
interesting. Still a relatively small community at that time. And so the idea for us was really to use that as a vehicle for attention, because you got to talk about, hey, there's this prize and we've got this like group of people that has a very specific skill set that everyone's looking for. And they're coming together to work on a social impact problem.
Because you mentioned a prize. Was that something that the NGO would give, or did you have sponsors for that as well? Like how did that work usually?
Either the NGO would give it or we had sponsors for it.
Right.
So we've done both over the course of the years, depending on, you know, where there's budget, where there's interest, where it's coming from. Mix of different funding sources.
And like, I mean, it's been 10 years or so at this point, so it might be hard to grab the number, but like to give the listener kind of an impression, how many of these competitions have you done in total? Like per year, would you say that there's like maybe one every 2 months or so? Is that the batting average?
Yeah, that's about right. So we've run, I think, 60-something on the drivendata.org platform. We also have white label deployments where we run challenges for other people in other contexts. And so we've probably done something like 100 challenges over the last 10 years. But 65 of them, I think, being this core social impact focus on the drivendata.org website.
Gotcha. And I think you also do something interesting with the competitions, because they're not all, there's a very classic sort of Kaggle-like thing where it's test set that we keep and then you train. But I think you also do a couple of more data mining things, right? Where you just say, hey, here's a fun data set, go nuts. And the person with the best slide deck afterwards gets the prize. Like, you also do some non-standard things that are a bit more qualitative as well on that platform, right?
Yeah, we've got a few different options for setting up challenges. One of them is this qualitative challenge where we have people submit either a written report or a video artifact, sort of walking through a demo of their solution or why it's interesting, or a set of slides. And then we have a judging panel, look at those, score them with a rubric, and then we end up with a set of winners out of that. We also have an engine for executing code that participants submit. And so if you're doing like a simulation or optimization problem, then we can run that kind of challenge as well. If you're looking for, putting resource constraints on what solutions might use, then it's very useful to be able to execute the code and get some sort of performance score in addition to your accuracy score.
Makes sense. Now, so I do want to call that out because I do think it's all these competitions can be very, very motivating. But because the game is so quantitative at some point, it sometimes does feel like you lose something. And I did always feel that the fact that you folks do that is kind of a nice touch. It sort of keeps the human in the loop. And it's also kind of, at times, it can feel more like real life. Because in real life at a company, you also have to present your work and also have to convince people that what you've done is interesting, right? So that does feel like a great exercise also for your portfolio in a way that you don't hyper optimize for the metric, but instead you think a little bit more holistically about it.
Yeah, we just ran one. I was really excited about where NASA was the sponsor of the challenge. And their goal was they wanted people around the world to use NASA data products, a lot of their satellite generated data from satellite sensors. They wanted people around the world to use that data to think about how their community might have that data inform progress towards one of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And what they wanted as submissions was basically a project pitch and a little example of how using some of their data makes sense in this community for a particular application towards those Sustainable Development Goals. And the prize for this challenge was you got to go to space camp for a week. And I was just jealous that, the winners of this challenge got to go to space camp, but that wasn't an opportunity for me. Employees of Driven Data are not allowed to compete in the competitions.
Maybe for the non-US listeners, a space camp, is that like when they do a launch? Is that what space camp is?
It's basically like a science camp, and so
it's that one. Yeah, those are pretty fun. Okay. I know.
They'll dress you up in the suit, and you do like zero gravity simulation thing, and you learn about astrophysics and all kinds of very cool
stuff. So Disneyland for those on the nerdy end of the spectrum.
Exactly. Yeah. Which turns out there's a fair amount of overlap with our challenge community.
I can see that.
Yeah. Are interested in space camp.
But I mean, it is cool that NASA, like a group, we've talked about this before. Like it is interesting to also see NASA sort of look at your platform kind of as a mindshare kind of a project. So it's also like a public brainstorming session like that, if you will. So there's a lot of stuff that I thought was like kind of different about Driven Data, the way you do competitions. And there were a lot of interesting things. But I kind of want to pivot here a little bit more towards the Dion checklist. Because, you were running all of these competitions. And at some point, you were thinking about like, A, I also have a background in philosophy and a little bit more in like practical ethics. And it felt like there was a Lego brick missing at that point as well, I think, right? And this was like, I think 2 years after you started the competition-ish?
So one of the things that happened when we started the competitions was we'd go to nonprofits. We said, hey, we've got this really cool thing where we can set up these challenges that we run. You get this community of data scientists involved. And we'd hear things like, we have no idea what kinds of questions we could ask with our data. We just need someone to like look at it and figure it out. Or, there's no way we could release the data because of privacy concerns. And so we couldn't be part of a challenge in which some of the data gets released to participants. And those organizations then followed that up with, but hey, can you help us to solve these tasks? And so after starting the challenge platform and starting to talk to these organizations, we also spun up a direct service arm where engineers on the Driven Data team work directly with organizations to solve problems. And this is sort of the piece that starts to get into the where Dion came from and the ethics checklist is this sort of broad set of work that we were doing with social impact organizations that wasn't just necessarily a machine learning problem, but maybe was helping them write a white paper or report that has some analysis in it, or like give an impact measurement presentation to their board and calculate the statistics for that in a rigorous way, or even help deploy machine learning solutions, set up data warehousing, set up dashboards, like all the pieces around just a machine learning algorithm that happens in the challenge.
So like a consultancy that helps put in all the cogs around the machine learning cog, so to say.
Exactly. And the machine learning cog, if that's the right thing at the right time.
Usually there's more than one cog, though, is my experience.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. There are lots of cogs. If people haven't read it, I need to just keep recommending that the paper Machine Learning is the High Interest Credit Card of Technical Debt.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Great paper. The title says it all. You may not even need to read it, but it is. It's a gem.
Yeah, agreed. But okay, but you were then trying to apply this stuff like properly, right? So you're in the NGO, you've ran the competition, you've got that platform, but you're also doing a bit of consulting, and then you're also exposing yourself a little bit more to the problem, right? So it makes sense that you then also start to observe. And I think that you started observing that, hey, there are these like themes of ethics that just keep coming back up, right?
Yeah, and it was part of the conversation that data scientists were having at the time too. So I think like one of the big bellwethers was in 2016, ProPublica released this analysis of the COMPASS algorithm, which is a statistical model that is used to predict if someone in a parole or probation hearing is going to reoffend, if they're going to commit a crime, if they're released at that hearing, and they give them a risk score based on that. And ProPublica did this analysis that showed that the algorithm that was being used, that was just sold to courts by a third party, commercial third party, was biased against African-American defendants. And that moment of using data science to show that an algorithmic decision was biased in a way that was not appreciated by the people using that algorithm was kind of, I think, eye-opening for a lot of people in the data science community. And
so in what sense was it that the judges kind of trusted the algorithm blindly, and therefore that as a data scientist you had to sort of account for that? Was that the main concern that people talked about, or was it something else?
Yeah, so the algorithm just took all of the case information and gave a risk score, like low, medium, high risk score for recidivism. And that was one of the things that the judge considered. What is this score ranking in the decisions that they were making? But they didn't know anything about the model that's underlying that score.
Right. So then, gotcha.
And so that, I think, was one of these moments where the data science community started to pay attention and say, let's think about the broader systems that our algorithms get embedded in. And like, we shouldn't build algorithms that harm people. The community sort of talked about, well, maybe we need something like medicine has, where medicine has a Hippocratic oath, where they say the foremost duty of a doctor is to do no harm. And maybe we need the same thing for data science, that we've got a professional society that has an oath that we adhere to, that we should do no harm. And that was one of the things that sort of got me thinking, because I've always been interested in the more practical side of ethics. And an oath is a great sort of target, but I'm interested in how do people operationalize that? What's the way in which I avoid doing harm if that's my goal? What do I think about in order to navigate that path? And as we started to do more projects and see more ways in which data science projects can go wrong, and to get more examples in the popular press and media, we started to think about, okay, what are the kinds of things that a data scientist can do in their process to help avoid these potential risks that we're seeing or these harms to end users?
And I'm going to paraphrase this slightly, but I could translate this as, hey, it's really easy to fit predict, but it's a lot harder to sort of think about the bigger picture in terms of like harm that the algorithm might actually do. And you were sort of trying to sort of answer that question of, hey, how can we make that easier? Because it feels like it's just too easy to fit predict and therefore also make a big mistake. Like, I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but it feels like this was the vibe you were sort of chasing that.
Yeah, well, it's almost like it's almost like the scikit-learn, to use a scikit-learn analogy, which seems appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
It's like the scikit-learn pipeline model, where it's like, it's not just fit predict, but you've got a transform step in there as well, and maybe you've got some like scaling that you do, and you've got a few steps that you go through in the data science process. And so it is. Yeah. What do you think about at each of those steps that might have ethical concern?
Oh, yeah. So, So what is the standard scaler for ethics? What is the what is the imputer for? Yeah, okay. So they're not estimators or anything like that, but it does make sense. You see them as a sequence of steps you kind of got to go through, so to say. You were kind of looking for something tangible in that regard.
Yeah, and looking for something that that data scientists could embrace to make part of their process. So like one of the things that we think about is that the mechanism for change goes through the data scientists that are actually building algorithms. And by those folks that are building those algorithms, thinking about the work that they're doing in careful ways and bringing these conversations around ethics into their work, it can help guide where organizations go, where and how they use machine learning, and to what degree they embrace, responsible AI, fairness, and ethics in their work.
So what I imagine at this point, right, is like you've gone to a couple of clients and you're not alone, right? Like you've got colleagues, so you can sort of huddle, you can have coffee, and you know, conversations start to happen at this point. And then... do you immediately kind of go like, okay, we have to build a tool? Or was it also that you were yourself just kind of searching and thinking like, hey, what's the actual thing that we need here? Because I can also imagine like, what's the solution going to be? Like, that's also kind of an open-ended question at that point, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it started as an internal tool, like really just in a document for us in doing our work. What do we think about when we're assisting with data collection? You know, considering things like informed consent, and representativeness of the sample that we're looking at. What do we think about when we're storing and holding data for organizations? How is that data protected? How do we think about access controls for the data? Do we have the need to share or even store sensitive information about the people represented in the data set?
One thing I wonder, right? It sounds like, as most things in life, this started as a Notion document. And at some point, you just start writing things down. And at some point, it becomes kind of like a bulleted list because you're trying to structure stuff around. Mm-hmm. But was it also that because you had it in writing, it started looking more and more like a checklist? Is that kind of the path that that it ended up taking? Or was it also because you felt like you wanted to have something that's just kind of tangible, where I just don't want to forget any of these steps? Like, how did you end up with a checklist is kind of what I'm wondering now.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Part of it is that the idea of having more checklists in general was having a zeitgeisty moment. So there was a piece published in The New Yorker around the same time, I'm pretty sure by Atul Gawande, that was about different applications of checklists in medicine to help prevent errors and how that's been particularly effective. And so sort of going from this idea that, you know, a checklist is like, what's the order of switches that you flip in a cockpit to get your plane to take off, to the checklist is, okay, what are the things I'm making sure to check on so that I can reduce that cognitive overhead of trying to hold all of the potential downstream bad harm cases in my head because I've got ways to make sure that I'm checking those each time.
And there's a really nice link to the Hippocratic Oath over there. Like, it's great if you've taken the oath, but stuff can still go wrong. And that's why we have checklists in medicine. If you're going to start doing the surgery, did you wash your hands? Like, I'm not a medical professional, so I don't know the details. Like, but I would imagine, like, before you do like a proper surgery, you do the checklist. And there might even be laws around that, or at least norms, right?
I think it varies from field to field. Again,
medicine, but
not my area of expertise.
Sure, no, but the main point is, like, you need more than just an oath, right? And I can also imagine that's then probably the main realization. Like, you need more than an oath, and probably the best thing, at least to get started with, is a sensible checklist. And then you can sort of iterate on the stuff that's actually on the checklist. You can test it. But I can definitely imagine, like, you've got this Hippocratic Oath in your mind, that there's kind of like an aha moment when you read that medical analogy.
Yeah, to say, oh, we're starting to get like, we had sort of, in our head, we're sort of basing things that we were talking about around the data science process. So data collection, storage, exploratory work, modeling, deployment, and thinking about, okay, what do we consider at these different stages? And that became sort of the backbone for the checklist. At each of these stages, we'll have checklist items. Did you consider if there's a mechanism for redress for people that are harmed by your deployed algorithm, for example? And so those sort of things came together and we said, oh, this is starting to become useful for us, for our work, and we think it would be useful more broadly. And it's the kind of thing that provides structure and framework for data scientists to have discussions on their team about ethical issues. So that was really the start of the Dion checklist. And then it became a Python package, really as a way to like sneak it into data science projects, right? Like, how do we put this sort of like tangential ethical concern into the workflow that data scientists are doing every day?
If you want Python people to use a checklist, it makes it a whole lot easier if you can pip install one.
you got to put it on PyPI. And so, now you can pip install Dion. It's got a command line. You go, you just type Dion and you get a new ethics checklist that's in an ethics.markdown that's just in your repo that just has the items to consider. And as a team, you get to decide how exactly you use that framework in your work.
Yeah, and this is also the point in time in the conversation where I have the Dion like website in front of me, because I think we're going to go over some of your favorite points. But I guess like the short story is you type Dion and you say like, here's, I want the file to go there. It makes a checklist, but I think there's like general themes that it sort of tries to generate. So you've got data collection, data storage, analysis, modeling, and deployment. And for all of those items, there are like points, but it also deserves to be mentioned that you can also add custom items as well, because typically organizations, they will have like legal, you know, Bob from legal. Right. And Bob from legal also wants to be able to add stuff to the checklist. But well, one thing that like if you go to the website, like one thing that is kind of nice is when you go to the data collection bit, and I'm just going to like read, I suppose, is data collection. Like, what do you need? Well, there's informed consent. There's also collection bias. Like the way you collect your data could have a consequence if you don't think about it. You really want to limit the personal identifiable information. And there's also downstream bias stuff that you might want to mitigate. And then every point has a proper little sentence. But one thing I wanted to... So we're going to talk about these points in particular, but one thing that I would be remiss if I didn't mention, all of those points, and I do have to sort of... you have to click the examples tab. But for every one of these points, you have done the archival effort of finding not just bad examples, like newspaper articles where that issue has failed, but also good ones. Like that I thought was a particularly nice touch. Like if the informed consent one in particular. A voiceover studio is now required to get informed consent from a performer before using their likeness in AI-generated content. So that, like, you also mentioned the good examples that are happening in this domain.
Yeah, well, we just added that recently with the idea that we were actually seeing more of those. Hey, someone took this concern into account and they implemented it in how they think about their data science pipeline. And so we shouldn't only say, hey, here's a horrible example where someone's private information got leaked because someone left an old S3 bucket lying around with open permissions, right? And so there's a checklist item like, what is your data retention policy? At what point do you delete people's private data because you don't need it anymore? And that's one of the bad examples. But we started to see places where people actually were taking these ideas seriously and trying to implement them in their work. And so we wanted to highlight those good examples as well to say, hey, here's a place where it can go wrong. You can bring that as evidence to your internal discussions and say, these are the kinds of things that might happen if we don't pay attention here. But you can also now point to organizations and say, and they're doing a good job at this because you know they've implemented this particular process.
I'm just picking one that I think is a particularly nice one. And if you have a favorite, we're going to scroll to that in a bit. But like one thing I'm currently looking at is just the collection bias. Like the way that you collect your data can have a bad influence on the outcome of whatever system you have. And even if you don't do anything with machine learning per se. And it's a relatively small example, but I think the Street Bump one was a nice one. This was a smartphone app where you were able to make like photos of the road that had like a pothole in it or needed to have, you know, have someone come with a shovel to fix it. But this was early in the mobile phone era, I think. And then you could wonder, well, there might be parts of town that have more smartphones than other ones. And therefore, your data is going to be biased and you're not going to get like the complete view of where the potholes are. But if that's going to be the main input for your system to fix potholes and only certain parts of towns are going to get their potholes fixed. It's a relatively small example, but I do think it's a very clear example of collection bias of, and something that could break the system downhill.
And this is one of the reasons why the checklist is so valuable, because anyone who's listening, who's a data scientist, is going to say, oh, of course, right? Like, oh, of course, that's the kind of thing that's going to bias the results. But if you're not thinking about all of these different things systematically in a framework, then you might miss one at some point. You might be focused on a different part of the problem. And so each one should be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And together as a whole, they provide a more robust framework for making sure that you're guarding against all kinds of different harms, not the ones that you happen to think about on a given day.
Yeah, and in this particular case, what I also think is just interesting is obviously, it's a good idea to make it as easy as possible for people to report potholes. Like that's like the origin of the story is really, really innocent and comes from a really good place. It's just that it's very easy to have like a subtle mishap happening there. Yeah,
I mean, I think that brings up another point is that the checklist isn't prescriptive either. We don't tell you how to solve that problem because that's the thing that requires hard domain specific knowledge of what's going on. So if you take this pothole reporting one, is the way to solve it that you just don't deploy this system so you don't get this information about potholes? Probably not. But maybe the mitigation is you deploy more of the city's resources in finding potholes in communities that aren't being represented in the data that you're getting from the mobile phone app.
Yeah, or you make sure that there's also still a phone line that's available if people wanted to, or a website, something that doesn't necessarily need a smartphone or an app, right? Like there's other things you can do.
Exactly.
But you have to think about it, preferably up front.
Yeah, you have to think about it, preferably up front, preferably as the data science, you're like, data scientist, you're raising these concerns and saying, hey, like, we'll deploy this application, but we should also think about that, like, not everyone's going to have a smartphone. And so how are we covering those areas as well? And the earlier that happens in the process, the more it can be built into the operations around a machine learning algorithm.
Yeah. And it deserves to be said, like, this is one of the many, many points on this checklist, right?
Yeah.
So there's definitely more. And I also think it's kind of fair that you, like, do you have a favorite one by any chance? Because I just picked mine.
Yeah, I guess I have one that has become my favorite because of LLMs. It's become my favorite because I worry it's doing too much work on its own. So down in the deployment section, which is the last section of the playlist or of the checklist, we have an item, the very last item, which is unintended use.
Oh boy, does that carry a lot of stuff?
A lot of stuff. You know, have we taken steps to identify and prevent unintended uses and abuse of the model? And do we have a plan to monitor these once the model is deployed? And for us in thinking about this originally, this is more like the YouTube recommendation algorithm, right? Like, oh, is this getting gamed by people in a particular way? That's the like unintended use that was sort of in our heads at the time. But now with LLMs, that surface area is so much broader. There are so many things that the models can do because they're generating text and imagery that I think weren't sort of captured in our minds as possibilities when the checklist started. And so it's become my favorite because there's basically no, there's no dissecting all of the possible unintended uses of these large multimodal models. It's impossible to catalog those ahead of time.
Although I should say, like, one thing that I do find interesting on that one is, I mean, like, if I look at the link that's attached, so there's one link about deepfakes, and that links to an article that explains to the deepfake concern, but that's 2018. So it's not necessarily a new concern or anything like that. But it does make me kind of wonder, like you're pretty modest in terms of examples that you've attached. I think there is, like, max three articles. Oh, okay, yeah, I found one that has, like, six, but usually... it's not like you've got hundreds and hundreds of examples attached.
Right.
But you could, I think. Like, I can definitely imagine if you spent your time looking, you would be able to add lots of stuff to this list. So is it also the case that, like, to find these examples of stuff gone wrong, do you kind of have a feeling of, well, when we have two really good ones per example, it's fine, and then we need, like, a really, really good example to add it to the list? Like, what's the process behind, like, what makes for a good example to explain this?
Yeah, so... part of it was just we didn't have the same volume of examples when we started the list. And so, like, this was, I think, probably pretty comprehensive of the major data scandals when we first launched the tool. And so, you know, like the Equifax data leak, right, was one of these huge data breaches.
Oh, I remember that,
that
one.
Was particularly important in the public press, right? And so it was like, okay, we'll take these big media stories and we'll see where those fit in the checklist.
So I also see the Dutch prime minister entire cabinet resigns after investigations reveal 26 Dutch person of my generation will forget that. No, Dutch person my generation will ever forget that. So that makes sense. Like, you're also going for stuff that's memorable at some point, because that also is, like, really good to bring to your boss, right? Like, if it's a very minor news story in some small town somewhere, it doesn't really carry as much weight as something that we all remember because, oh boy, that was on the news for weeks.
And like you're saying, the goal isn't to be a catalog of all of the things that have ever gone wrong.
It's just to motivate the checklist.
How do we make the checklist concrete? How do you see the implications of the guidelines that are in the checklist?
Yeah, and it would also defeat the purpose of the checklist if it actually became a catalog, because you now have a modest, like, you can look at the thing within an hour and get a pretty comprehensive idea of stuff you should check, and the moment you turn it into, like, a master's thesis, it sort of beats the purpose.
That was one of the goals, was to keep it manageable, short and manageable. The idea was that you want it to be the kind of thing that you can talk through in a medium length meeting. So if you took 2 hours, your team could work through a plan for these items and talk about them together.
Or at least get a good chunk of it done. Like, you might still need to talk to Bob from legal, but
Right. Get a take at least on all of the items. Whereas, like, I think some of the other sort of checklist tools are more designed to have, like, a document-driven process where it's like, okay, here's a very long checklist where you have to, like, add to this document where and how exactly you did this thing. And this is much more of a discussion and planning-oriented checklist.
So, and I think there's something interesting about that as well, because what is the sort of... end goal of the checklist? Like, one use case I can imagine, right, is, like, you can check this checklist into Git together with all of your other data assets and stuff, and if you put it into Git, you can also confirm that it was signed off at some point. And that's a you know, legit use case, I suppose. But I can also imagine it's not necessarily the main use case. Like, what if you were to look back and sort of look at the impact that this tool has made, would you kind of say, well, if this tool really changed anything, it's maybe this. Like, what's the most tangible thing you think the tool has contributed at this point?
Yeah, I mean, where we see the most adoption is in people who are educating data scientists. So lots of university programs have taken the checklist as part of their curriculum. And that's the way in which the checklist and the considerations on it have made their way into the data science community and into the community of practice. And I think that's interesting because always our sort of theory of change related to the checklist was that individual data scientists have a lot of autonomy around these particular decisions. They get to voice their concerns about how we think about the bias that might exist in the data, or do some additional analysis to see if it's if the algorithm is fair to specific underrepresented groups. And so having those considerations front of mind for data scientists, because this was part of their data science education, I think is probably the way that it's had the biggest impact. And so we've gone and we've given a lot of talks and trainings, both at data science conferences, but then also at lots of universities as well that have these data science programs.
And then one thing I kind of wonder is, and we also, you mentioned it before as well, so classrooms, make sense, right? Like, check. Like, definitely makes sense that this is part of curricula. People can learn lessons from it. But if I were to think about how this is applied in the business, right? You mentioned before that it also sort of starts a conversation and it might also spark the debate.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of wondering, like, is that maybe not the best impact you can actually have? Like, the fact that that conversation is actually happening in the first place. Because maybe without such a checklist, that would not happen, right? And just like how with the Hippocratic Oath, that's not enough. Like, probably the checklist is great, but it's not about the tick marks. It is about the fact that this conversation is happening at all, right?
Yeah. There's some great research that came out of Microsoft research around how checklists like this give agency to individuals within systems. And it's the kind of thing where you bring the checklist to leadership and you say, hey, this is the kind of thing that should be part of our process. You know, we're going to protect from these kinds of harms. We all want to do that. And when it gets built into the process, then it gets considered in all of the operations that are happening. And individuals can say, point to a checklist item and say, hey, you know, we haven't spent enough time thinking about our, like, monitoring and rollback if we're getting bad predictions from this algorithm. And so because it's got this structure around it that can be adopted everywhere, it becomes a tool that individuals can use to increase their agency around these ethical considerations.
Yeah, and I can also imagine, like, as a single practitioner person, you can actually come up, you can go up to your boss and you can kind of say, look, as far as a standard goes, this checklist is pretty close to it. Like, if there's ever been a checklist, this is on GitHub. It has lots of stars. People have liked it. People have used it. There's courses about it. It's used in universities. We should probably not ignore it. I can definitely imagine that if that person didn't have, like, that checklist as a backing up mechanism, like, defending the hill and standing your ground is also a bit trickier.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it gets even harder on any one individual consideration where it's like, oh, you know, like, partway through the project, I'm going to, like, wave my hands and be like, oh, I'm a little worried that, like, we're not, that our sampling is biased. People are like, well, we got to ship things. We've got timelines. That's going to slow things down. We haven't thought about that yet. Like, why are you, like, throwing all these considerations up that are going to slow down the work? And so the framework lets you say, hey, this is part of what we've agreed to as a team we care about. And so these items, when we bring them up, deserve consideration.
Yeah, and it's also, so the goal is, of course, not to slow a project down, but it is to offer, like, but it is there to sort of, hey, we should think about an insurance policy because there's risk, right? If we want to minimize that risk, this is the way, like, the checklist is sort of the way to do it.
It's to slow you down just enough to prevent certain kinds of errors, right? That's what a checklist is for. That's what it is in the medical domain too, right? Like, it's going to slow you down to some degree.
And if you
get something out of that.
Yeah, and also, like, if you really want to get slowed down, oh boy, just wait until the lawyers get here.
Right, right.
When we mess up and then the lawyers come, that's going to be the biggest slowdown you'll ever get.
Yeah, they don't always make a nice, clear checklist for you.
No. Like they might give you forms to fill in, but not a checklist. not making it that easy for you. So I guess I hope at least to the people who are listening that they're sort of becoming curious about this tool and that they're also sort of eager to have a look at it. I guess like a final sort of question and maybe sort of observation more has to do with like stuff that we've seen recently, like, you know, the last 2 years. You can generate almost any image you like, and you can also generate almost any text that you like. And I did also, like, through the grapevine, notice that there was, like, some more activity on the GitHub repo, like, somewhat recently. But it does look like the checklist hasn't changed that much. Like, is that assertion accurate?
Yeah. So one of the things that, as maintainers of this checklist and package, we've been trying to figure out is, like, are LLMs different from other machine learning models in ways that matter to the checklist? And so one of the things that philosophers that work on ethics like to do is try to figure out if something is a difference in degree, i.e. it's the same kind of thing, it's just more or less
of it,
or a difference in kind, that is, it's a totally different category. What we've been trying to figure out is, like, are the things that we're seeing from LLMs differences in kind such that we should change the checklist in some way? I think that, like you said, a number of the generative AI use cases have, like, gone into, the unintended use bucket. Right? And that starts to become a big bucket. And that's one of the indicators that, like, maybe it's not quite specific enough. But I think there are other considerations that are coming up too. One of the big things with LLMs is, where is your training data coming from? And do the people who are generating that data have, quote, informed consent in a way that makes sense? I mean, if you're scraping the internet, what are your rights to using that language? And there's litigation about that now.
Yeah, that's a big one.
And so, like, maybe there are different considerations that need to go in the checklist around just the data collection side, not even way down at the deployment side. One of the other things that I think about with LLMs this current wave of AI is a lot of people are talking about these agentic systems. So when you have agents out in the world that are doing things autonomously, how does that change the deployment items in our checklist? Is that just another deployment of a machine learning model? Or are there things that are substantially different about those systems that we need to consider? And something I don't have a good answer to yet.
But looking at some other points, I mean, just monitoring and evaluation, like, I have not heard of anyone say, like, I have an LLM deployment, trained it myself. Boy, the monitoring and evaluation, that's the easy bit. Like, right. Usually, just from a technical standpoint, that's the hardest bit. Like, how on earth are you going to come up with a number that represents the thing you're actually interested in reality? Like, that's super hard with these systems. You can come up with some proxies, but a single number that's, like, fully trusted? I've not heard anyone sort of claim that yet.
I mean, that's a great point that, like, that was easy when we were doing classification, right? And it's like, okay, what are my error rates for the classifications that I was making? And when you're generating text, getting some reasonable, like you're saying, score of the quality of that text along whatever dimension you care about.
I might be able to lift that one further. Like, let's suppose that we are talking about, like, proper classification and we are able to do, like, binary classification, yes, no, ones and zeros. Also, just just accuracy metric isn't necessarily giving me the full picture either, right? I might have more metrics that are easier to calculate, but it's not the same as having a clear picture of when something might be going wrong, right? So, like, it's a minefield.
It is a minefield. And so I think, like, it goes to this other piece I've been thinking about recently. Is, like, it feels like a lot of the generative AI and LLM considerations really fit in this deployment bucket. Not all of them, but a lot of them do. And one of the things that has made me think about is that our theory of change for Dion was that we've got this highly specialized community of data scientists. It's a small community. It's one that, like, you can have a broad conversation with. And this is how, like, bioethics norms get enforced, right? where they say, okay, we're not going to do certain kinds of genetic research as a community because we have a small set of practitioners that's actually able to do that research. We have a set of ethical norms we adhere to around that. And that works for data scientists, but once it becomes the case that a deployed machine learning system is just an API call, like these LLMs are, then all of a sudden, anyone who's a software engineer or even can do a little bit of programming becomes someone who can deploy a machine learning system. And so does it even work to have the theory of change be focused at this level of data scientist? And so how do we handle that structural change that's happening with these models being API calls that are unpredictable and the responsibility for what those models do being diffused, not just to the organizations creating them, but also the ones that are using them as tools in their products. And that's another one that I think we don't have a good answer to yet.
It remains a minefield. I think the simplest way to sort of put it. But at least within the minefield, I do think it's a nice sort of testament that I think I got exposed to the Dion checklist like 7 years ago. And I remember making a PR such that Dion can also be called as a module, like a tiny little thing. I was sort of drawn to it.
Thank you for your contributions.
But I was sort of drawn to it because it's very hard to look at a point and kind of go, that's unreasonable. Like everything on the list just seems very, very reasonable. And one thing also from this conversation that I think is also an interesting main lesson is, originally, I thought having this in Git and having that be the actual checklist that people actually check off, that might be the thing that is gonna do a whole lot of good. But then I learned that not a whole lot of people are actually doing that practice. But also after having this conversation with you, I think that might not be the worst thing either, because it's also designed to get the conversation started, and that it does seem to be doing. Which I think is interesting about the project.
To be honest, the only signal that we have that people are using it is public repos and
GitHub issues, maybe. Yeah.
Right. And so I think there's a fair amount of use that we don't even see. One of the Microsoft research papers that looks into these checklist items talks about how they got a sample of practitioners and asked them what they did. And one of the people says, we used the Dion checklist in our data science work. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. But that's not the kind of thing that, we see, because it's just in a private entity, the way that their data science team operates.
And it's also kind of one of these things where you can install in a virtual environment and still have that checklist copied in the repo, and then that gets copied 10 times, but it's still just one download from PyPI ever.
And so, the statistics that we have on usage, I think, are not comprehensive.
Well, but if nothing else, I do think it's a honking good idea. People should just go check it out. And that's also why I was very keen to have you on this podcast. Since we are wrapping up right now, are there any things you would like to send people off with? Your name is Peter Bull, your company is Driven Data, but people can check that out, check out the competitions, they're pretty fun. Anything else you would like to tell people, how can they find you or other projects that they should have a look at?
Definitely please come join the challenges. Lots of interesting things there for people with data science skills. That's drivendata.org. Check out the rest of our open source library. So in addition to the checklist, we maintain a bunch of technical tools. So the cookie cutter data science project template
is one
that we maintain. We have a project called CloudPathLib that lets you use the PathLib API for S3 buckets or Google storage or Azure Blob storage. We've got another package called Erdantic that lets you create an entity relationship diagram for Pydantic models. So it lets you create this visual representation of your Pydantic model structures. Come use those, contribute whatever is useful to you. We're hiring right now at Driven Data, so check out our jobs board looking for data scientists. I would be remiss if I didn't say that.
Very good. In the U.S., though, it deserves to be said, right? You're in the...
Yep. Remote, but U.S.-based. And then I guess the last thing is we're always looking for interesting clients and projects to work on. So if you're looking for a smart data science team that likes solving holistic problems, you should definitely reach out.
There you go. Peter, this was super cool. Thanks for being on. And see you around the internet and GitHub.
Yeah, well, thanks, Vincent. I really appreciate it.
Have a good one.
You too.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Sample Space. As always, we will make sure that all the show notes will include all the links and references to things that we've mentioned in the talk. But moreover, if you've enjoyed this episode, please let us know. We are also very keen to hear any suggestions on people that you think will be excellent guests for this show, so definitely feel free to reach out on our social channels if you have a good suggestion. Once again, thanks for listening.